Hi, podcast listeners. We'd like to tell you about an important PLI one-hour briefing. In the last 2 years, the Supreme Court has dramatically moved constitutional law in a conservative direction. Once again, the Supreme Court's docket for the October 2023 term is filled with cases of great legal and social importance that will profoundly affect the lives of many. On April 29, join Dean Erwin Chemerinsky for PLI's one-hour briefing titled Supreme Court, October Term 2023, Another Year of Major Decisions. Dean Chemerinsky will provide a review of the major cases this term, including those concerning gun rights, the power of federal administrative agencies, social media content and speech on the internet, and more. Register now at pli.edu/sc23. That's pli.edu/sc23. This program is brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute, a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys, professionals, and accountants at the forefront of knowledge and expertise.
Hello, and welcome to the Insecurities Podcast, keeping it fresh and staying wonky on the latest securities regulatory and enforcement developments with a practitioner's perspective on the stories you should be following. This is Kurt Wolf, and unfortunately, I am flying solo today. It's a shame that Chris can't be here with us because we have got a great show, a great guest, really, lined up to talk about the role of financial advisors, the duty of care they owe their clients, and of course, Chris's favorite topic, regulation best interest. So without any further ado, let me introduce our guest. We are joined today by Knut Rostedt. He is the co-founder and president of the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard, a not-for-profit think tank formed for the purpose of preserving, protecting, and defending fiduciary principles in investment and financial advice. More on the Institute in just a couple of minutes. Before he founded the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard, Knut served as the Regulatory and Compliance Officer at Rembert Pendleton Jackson, an investment advisor in Falls Church, Virginia. Knut is a recognized thought leader in the advisor industry. He writes frequently on the role of fiduciary principles, including the ebook Fiduciary Common Sense. He's been cited in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, Reuters, and other industry outlets, like with our friends over at Investment News. Knut was also honored in 2021 by the Fiduciary Standard Committee as Fiduciary of the Year. And in 2014, IA Magazine named him one of the 25 most influential people in and around the advisor industry. Knut, we are excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm absolutely delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Let's get started. Let's jump right in. One of the things we like to do, Knut, when we have folks like you who come from a membership organization or an industry advocacy group or a think tank, is just talk a little bit about what it is they do day to day, what their organization does. So, as I mentioned, the Institute for the Fiduciary Standard, which was founded in 2011, exists to preserve, protect, and defend fiduciary principles in investment advice and financial planning. I just want to set a quick baseline. A fiduciary is an individual or firm that occupies a special position of trust and confidence. It is the highest standard of conduct that is expected under the law. Simply put, a fiduciary must act in the best interest of his or her clients without regard to the fiduciary's own financial interest. So I wanted to set that baseline for listeners, make sure we're all kind of singing from the same sheet of music. And with that background, Knut, I'll go ahead and be quiet. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Institute? Why are you focused on promoting a fiduciary standard, and to whom should it apply?
Sure. Well, listen, thank you again, Kurt. The Institute was founded in 2011, and it was founded at a time when the SEC was just taking up the issue of whether and how broker-dealers should be held to a fiduciary standard. So that's why we came into being. And we came into being to form a legal entity that was solely dedicated to this singular mission and involved in nothing else. And We advance our mission by through policy research, through education, and through advocacy towards regulators, policymakers, advisors themselves, and to some degree to investors as well. So that's what we do, you know, on a day-to-day basis. We just completed Fiduciary September. I think you're going to come back to that later on, and you know that's a good snapshot of who's involved in what in our activities and what sorts of issues within the fiduciary realm that we focus on.
Yeah, thanks for that overview. We definitely will talk a little bit about Fiduciary September. I think towards the end, I want to leave that for folks to circle back to so they can learn more about the Institute. Sure. and some of the helpful information that you're putting out into the world. I know among your priorities, or you know, the Institute's priorities over the past several years has been regulation best interest, and it's something that I think sort of hits people differently, kind of depending on your perspective or your view of the world. You know, we've talked about it a bunch here on this podcast. Chris and I often joke, I think we've talked about it on something like 25 of our 77 episodes so far. It really has been something that we've been focusing on and think about as something our listeners care a lot about. You know, for anybody who is just tuning in for the first time or isn't familiar, essentially regulation best interest was one of three rules or regulatory interpretations that was announced in June 2019 that applied to brokers or investment advisors. And essentially what the package did together, I'll quote Jay Clayton here, but what he says the package did was bring the legal requirements and mandated disclosures for broker-dealers and investment advisors in line with reasonable investor expectations. Now, they take a little bit of a different tack with respect to brokers and investment advisors through that rulemaking package. But, Knut, I want to pause there just to see if there are any aspects of Reg BI or the fiduciary interpretation that you would highlight, or if you would just otherwise describe that package differently.
Right. Okay. Well, yes, I will absolutely describe it differently than does the SEC describe it. But I want to go back just for half a step, because I sort of jumped over this in my earlier remarks about why we exist and what we do. We don't use the terminology that you use that we use in terms of our preserving, protecting, and defending fiduciary principles, because in our view, fiduciary principles for the last 25 years have been under severe attack by the regulators themselves, led by the SEC, and in a separate way, in a different way from the industry. So those words are chosen for a purpose and with meaning. You know, our purpose, frankly, is to not have fiduciary duties, for the fiduciary concept, go the way of the dodo bird or go the way of dinosaurs, because that is exactly where we're headed now, based on what the SEC has done. So I want to sort of use that as a backdrop in terms of your question about Reg BI, because it is closely related. Reg BI that came out in June 2019, as you say, in our view, was in a material way 10 years in the making. And 10 years in the making by the SEC, starting with Chairman Shapiro in 2009, when one day after, and because of where, you know, where you're sitting, Kurt, you certainly remember and know this, one day after the Treasury Department announced its white paper, Chairman Shapiro ran up to New York City and got in front of the New York Writers Association and gave this speech about how wonderful fiduciary duties are and how great it is and how, you know, how she was so excited about it. But then in the speech, and you will remember, she said, oh, by the way, there's not a great deal of difference between what brokers do and advisors do. And that should have been a flashing red light that every RIA in the land should have stood up and said, oh, Chairman Shapiro, what do you mean by that? Because that was huge. And what she meant by that, and I have labeled it the doctrine of apparent similarities, some such thing. What she said, if two different entities look alike, they should be regulated alike. That's essentially what she said. And, you know, from a legal point of view, And again, not very many people stand up and say this because, and you know this, Kurt, how many people advance in their career by criticizing the SEC? But she merited criticism because it was an absurd and bizarre doctrine that she said, if two different entities appear to be the same, they should be regulated the same. And that has driven from 2009 to 2019, where Jay Clayton got us with the final rule. And I think that explains a lot. So that's how I look at it and say that. So when you say, you know, what is it about the Reg BI? I say almost everything about it is wrong. Almost everything about it is inconsistent with precedent, is not in the investor's best interest. And, you know, so that's where I start. And I think that's the case that we make. And, you know, again, one of the wonderful things about some of this in my mind is you don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be a securities attorney to understand the basic principles that have been so completely violated by Reg BI. And what I mean by that is anybody can go back and look at and look at the case of 1963 in the Supreme Court and read those about four pages about why do we have fiduciary advice? What purpose does it serve? And it's pretty clear. It to me, that case is sort of legal doctrine at its best, because the guy on Main Street can read it and pretty much understand it. And that's why I go back to that case all the time, because of that. So that's sort of the baseline where we start on this, and in terms of what should fiduciary mean in terms of how it's interpreted. And we look at Reg BI, and it's wrong in about every possible way that you can say. And again, in that same effort to go and look at the form CRS, that to me is the poster child of this 10-year effort that culminates in Reg BI. And what's so special about form CRS, and I have been contacted by allies in our fiduciary effort and say, Knut, why the hell are you paying so much attention to form CRS? And because they say that nobody understands what fiduciary means. And if they read it, they don't understand the form. So what's the big deal? And I say, are you kidding me? Do you really believe what you have said? Because what the big deal is, they have effectively banned the word fiduciary from what is alleged to be the most important disclosure for IAs and BDs. And so that is, to me, the poster child. That's the image that people should remember when they try to think about how bad Reg BI is. And so what that represents is the fact that the SEC has in Reg BI harmonized the standards in a way that we certainly didn't conceive of. RIAs, I don't think, conceived of 10 or 12 years ago when this effort began. They have harmonized the standards, A, so that brokers, dealers, and investment advisors appear to be virtually the same, sort of like identical twins, you can think of, you know, and that's the way that the SEC has done. And in doing that, they have concealed what is the core business of the broker dealer. And I don't use that word conceal lightly, but there is nowhere to be found, as far as I can see, in Reg BI, the explanation that broker dealers exist for a purpose. And their purpose is to do two things. It is either to execute trades or it is to distribute products. But that doesn't exist. That has been erased from the record. And that to me is sort of the epitome of what Reg BI is and why it's so terribly wrong. And that the result of that is that a well-educated consumer can read a form CRS and think, okay, this is the situation. And they have been misled. They have been grossly misled about how a BD and an IA are different. And that creates confusion. There's a whole nother session. I don't know whether you've done your sessions on investor confusion. My goodness, I could fill a whole hour on that alone because of what has happened there. But that investor confusion, it is dealt with today that it's sort of a given. And, my friends RIA say, it's a given what you can't do anything about it. And worse than that, frankly, Kurt, is that I think that if you were to get a candid assessment among the SEC staff around a table in that building, they would throw up their hands and say, gosh, we've tried so hard, but investors are still confused. And what can we do? And I think that many of them actually believe that in their hearts. And I think that they have basically misled themselves to believe that they can't do anything about it. Because actually, when you look at some of the SEC's own data, it suggests that investors do understand far more than the SEC gives them credit for. And the basis for their confusion is actually bad information. It's what they're being told, that is confusing to them by either the industry or the SEC, as opposed to being informed or being disclosed of basic facts, and they don't understand them. Those are two different things, and that is constantly confused. But what is missing from this picture, which my many friends in RIAs I think sometimes forget, is that the damage. Is not just that the fact that investors are confused and they make bad decisions, and that is true. The harm and the damage, and you go back to the Investment Advisors Act and the 1963 court case, and the Supreme Court says it there. The harm and the damage is to real fiduciary advisors. Real fiduciary advisors are basically given a bad rap because they're thrown in with bad advisors, and that piece of it seems to be forgotten by many of my friends in the RIA community, because they're not sure why they should be concerned about what we have today, why the SEC has done what it's done. They're not sure why it should matter to them. And it should matter to them because every single time whether it's an RIA or whether it's a BD betrays an investor, they are besmirched. They themselves are harmed by this. But that's not the way they look at it. So that's my short response to what's wrong with Reg BI.
I'd like to unpack that a little bit, Knut, because I've heard people say before that the failure to draw a distinction or a key line of demarcation between a broker and an investment advisor is frankly potentially harmful to either camp, right? But I know we're thinking today about RIAs. So, I mean, tell me some of the ways that RIAs are harmed by this sort of the blurring of the lines or the muddying of the waters. Is it just reputational or how is it?
Well, I mean, in a big sense, it is absolutely reputational because, and this is one of the answers I get, that investors can't tell the difference between advisors and broker-dealers. And yes, they're correct in saying that, but that's not an explanation. That's not an excuse for this. I mean, I guess a parallel would be, if we go back in history and look at the progression of the medical industry into a profession. There were a lot of quacks out there who were doing awful stuff in pushing medications or drugs under the guise that they were doctors. And the real doctors were harmed by that because for the same reason. Now, I think that when I say that many RIAs don't seem to think that this is important, I'll also say that I think many RIAs do see what's happening and they do think it's important, but A, they're not sure what they can do about it, A, and B, frankly, you look at the last 10 or 15 years, Kurt, and where have the assets been flowing? And so they've been flowing basically in one direction towards RIAs, so they can't feel the pain yet. And they can't feel the pain in terms of the damage to the indirect damage to their reputation. And, you know, at the same time, I know that a vast majority of the independent RIAs, and that's the ones that I think of, the independent ones, they have an ongoing inflow of new clients, and they literally don't experience the harm of the bad reputation. So I get that. But, you know, this is a short term phenomenon. And you don't have to be a gloom and doomer to say that, you know, when you look at in a broader sense, in a broader picture, what's happening out there in the marketplace, you look at some of the work that NASA, the state administrators, have done in terms of focusing on the finfluencers, for example. You know, there are some parallels to 1928 and 1929 that I don't think a lot of people want to look at, frankly. But that's what's out there. So I don't know how good an answer to that your question is, but anyway, those are some thoughts.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's helpful. It definitely makes it, I think, a little more understandable for folks who maybe just sort of can't put that advisor's hat on, right? It's not something they do every day, so they can't imagine, you know, how this rulemaking package would impact an RIA. I mean, I guess sort of on maybe sort of the practical side in terms of what happened as a result of, you know, Reg BI and the fiduciary standard interpretation, how is this impacting what RIAs do every day or have done or changed since the rulemaking, the interpretation came out? I mean, we hear about it a lot, for example, when the SEC's Division of Examinations puts out its annual priorities list or, you know, periodically puts out an alert that shares some of their findings from examinations. But what are you hearing in terms of how this is impacting the industry?
Well, I mean, you know, I'll be honest with you that most of what I hear is, you know, is frankly that, and again, this is the world of independent RIAs as to be distinguished between the dual registrants. That's another group. You know, they sort of throw up their hands and say, you know, yes, I see that what they're doing is not good, but I'm not feeling it yet. I'm not feeling the harm of what is happening there yet because the macroeconomics is working in their favor, which I just alluded to. So I think many of them see that it's wrong. I've had an influx of inquiries about this thing with CRS about, you know, are they really banning the word fiduciary from the form CRS? And I say effectively yes. And I use the word effectively because somebody somewhere in the bowels of the SEC, somebody will point out the fact that, oh, we're not banning the word fiduciary, and then try to explain to you why that's not the case. But and in a narrow technical sense, they are correct. But from an effective point of view, and nobody disagrees. There's not a compliance consultant, there's not a securities attorney, there's not a advisor advocacy group that I know that disagrees with the fact they have just banned the word fiduciary from this form. So to answer your question, the vast majority of them are not feeling any pain, any negative effect of this. And, you know, and that's understandable. And you could say, well, that's a positive sign because investors' assets are still coming from the other side, the RIA side. And that is good. But in the meantime, the fact that the fiduciary idea and the word fiduciary are being erased from the regulatory perspective, you know, that's a horrific development. And a lot of what we are fighting about, frankly.
And so what does the future look like for, you know, independent RIAs under this regulatory framework? And I mean, that could mean anything from increased compliance costs to enforcement risk or just, you know, sort of the business being eroded or diluted. What do you think the world looks like in a few years?
Well, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if I wasn't upbeat and optimistic about the future of RIAs, and particularly in the wealth management segment, particularly in the financial planning segment, because I absolutely believe that those in that segment of the broader RIA world, they're onto something that is so important and is so much needed and is so much appreciated by the marketplace that there that future should be great. And when I say should be, the caveat there is whether what the major regulator of RIAs is doing to try to eliminate their value proposition. And I don't use those words lightly, but that is essentially what they're trying to do. And in this sense, and I know we want to be relevant. I know we want to be, what deliverable do we have? But I think most people remember what Benjamin Franklin said when he left the Constitutional Convention about the Republic. And I wish that sentiment was more top of mind of RIAs, because Franklin said, you've got a republic if you can keep it. Yes, those last four words were absolutely critical. And Franklin was no dummy. And I say the same thing when I speak to young financial planners. And Kurt, they are the most wonderful group of people that you can speak to, because they're full of optimism. They're full of energy. They probably have read Dick Wagner's book, Financial Planning 3.0. I don't know whether that's been on your reading list, but I mean, it is just a wonderful introduction to the importance and the power of the career that they've started. And so it is great to hear them. But then I want to remind them that this thing called fiduciary, this thing called and they will use other terminology, which is fine to me, as long as they keep the same principles. It is here because, and many of them recognize it, that the baby boomers in their firms who are 30 years older than them, they fought tooth and nail for this, going back to the Merrill Lynch rule as just one example. And they recognize that, but I'm not sure they yet recognize, and I don't hold this against them because they're young, that they've got to continue doing that work. Otherwise, it will not necessarily be there tomorrow, because the powers that be will have their way. And it is the same thing as our founding fathers. You don't have to be a scholar of American history to know that in 1773, the good money in Europe was not on the colonists, Kurt. That's not where the good money was being bet. It was on King George. And so I just think we need to remember that.
No, I mean, I'm actually glad that you brought up the Merrill Lynch rule, because I think it's some important context here. This isn't the first time that there has been, sort of a blurring between the role of brokers and investment advisors. And if we go back sort of to the early 2000s, there was this case where the Financial Planning Association, which is a membership organization comprised of about 25,000-ish financial planners, they actually sued the SEC to set aside the Merrill Lynch rule, and they won. So the Merrill Lynch rule, just really quickly for those who don't know, this was known at the SEC as the rule called certain broker dealers deemed not to be investment advisors. And essentially, the rule authorized a practice that emerged in the 90s through which broker dealers were allowed to charge asset-based fees without having to register as investment advisors. I think today we certainly think about a transaction-based compensation as a hallmark of what is a broker dealer. Back then, this rule sort of allowed them to blur it. They let brokers earn asset-based fees. So in the lawsuit, the FPA argued successfully. The FPA said, if you're going to let the brokers go out and earn what look like investment advisory fees, then they should have to meet the same standard of conduct. And they won. Let me pause there, Knut. I tried to do that quickly, but what did I miss that you would highlight from that case?
Thank you for putting it on your list of things to discuss, because it's important for at a top level for at least two reasons. And one is, if you look at the individual firms that were fighting to get the FPA to challenge the SEC, Kurt, they're all small business people. Some of them were literally, one person shows. And, they discussed this for several years before they initiated the action in 2004. And it was controversial, because some of the FPA members thought this was the stupidest damn thing you could ever do, frankly. And you know, but there was a cohort there that said, no, this is right. When an individual hires, retains an advisor, they should expect fiduciary care. That is a reasonable expectation. And so those, that segment of the FPA won, you know, and frankly, the conventional wisdom at the time, Kurt, was these people are nuts. These people are crazy. What, are you going to take the SEC to court? What's wrong with you? You know, so, but that's what they did. And, you know, and as you know, 3.5 years later, in March 2007, lo and behold, the FPA wins. They win the lawsuit. And so, you know, so I think from a lesson of, you know, ordinary people doing extraordinary things and fighting and beating the far larger powers in a strategic way, you know, I think that's the first lesson, frankly. I think the second lesson is, you know, unfortunately, winning one victory is not always enough, because, you know, since then, as you well know, that victory has been overwhelmed by other actions by the industry and of the SEC to basically make it moot. And I use the word moot, and I think that again, Reg BI is the culmination of that, frankly. But I still, it is still an important lesson. And just as a sidebar, when I was looking into this, because we just had a panel in Fiduciary September on this issue, what I found from one of the individuals there is that the institutional history within the FPA itself does not include this lawsuit. There is no institutional history with it. And I said, are you kidding me? I mean, this is a major historic development, and it apparently has basically disappeared from the FPA. And so anyway, I'm glad that we had our panel on that. And anyway, I reiterate that I think it's very important.
I mean, that's very interesting that has sort of fallen out of, because as you say, it's not every day that an organization like that goes up against the SEC and wins. And on an issue that I think is probably really core to some of the issues that are important to them as an organization. I mean, you sort of alluded to the fallout from this case to the extent that you would call it that. But I mean, what has really happened since then? You said Reg BI is kind of like the culmination of things going in the wrong direction.
Well, yes. I look back, it's 2022. I look back the 15 year. And, you know, in fact, when I was giving some remarks about this last month, I alluded to my seventh grade history teacher, Mr. Edwards, because Mr. Edwards taught American history and the revolution from 1763 to 1783. And it was based on dates, and it was based on what happened on those dates. And I'm saying that if you really want to understand where we are today in 2022, you've got to do the same thing vis-a-vis the SEC and vis-a-vis the development of fiduciary. And I start with 2007 as the high mark. And from then on, Kurt, it's been basically downhill in my view. And you can start with chairman of the SEC in her remarks in 2009. And you can follow for that decade to see what the SEC has done to water down, to minimize, to almost marginalize the what I call the classic concept, the classic idea of fiduciary. And that's been a 10-year-long march, and we have some papers on that. But the point being that it, you know, nobody should have been surprised at what the SEC proposed with Reg BI in 2018, and nobody should be surprised at what was finalized in 2019, because, you know, this is at least 10 years in the works. And of course, if you read Professor Arthur Leiby's work, you know, he goes back to the 70s and 80s with the elimination of fixed brokerage fees and, you know, as the starting point. But really, I think it's the last 10 years to see what the SEC has done and to get us here today, such that what we have in Reg BI and CRS should be no surprise whatsoever. And And what we have there is basically their efforts. And you talk about, I can't remember the precise word you used about the line between advice and brokerage, but I say that the larger problem is not that the line has been erased, but that the idea and the principles of fiduciary are being erased as we speak, and I think that is seen in CRS, and then they've even gone one step further in sort of eliminating the word in the CRS. And I think that I want to point attention to the staff did this in 760 words in March of this year to explain why that the word fiduciary is, as they called it, quote unquote, extraneous. And, I think that they probably were more blunt, direct, and concise than they intended to be, because it really lays it out there what their thinking is. And I urge all RIAs to read that if they think that there isn't a problem that we face today.
So, with those comments actually kind of help some other comments you've made recently make a lot of sense, at least to me, right? So I was just reading an article that Mark Sheff wrote for Investment News. Mark's actually a guest who's been on the podcast before as well. But you said in a recent interview with Mark Sheff that you've lost faith in the SEC and that you fear they will continue on this path of eroding the fiduciary standard. So, I guess we've talked a little bit about the future before. You said you're kind of optimistic, but in terms of what might happen at the SEC, what are your concerns in terms of things that they might do or not do?
Yeah, well, okay. Yeah, just 30 seconds of context for that remark to Mark, and he absolutely recorded correctly. With this new SEC, it should never be forgotten how someone could look at the background and the resume of the current SEC chair and say, huh, this guy is different. Gary Gensler is different. And he's different in about three crucial ways that separate him from every SEC chair, in my mind, until the early years of Arthur Levitt, frankly, in that Gary Gensler had a demonstrated record that he would go against the forces of Wall Street to get what he wanted. He did this at the CFTC, as you know. Number two, he had shown that he didn't want to go back into Wall Street after he had become one of the youngest partners at Goldman Sachs and had done very well there. And so what did he do? He went to MIT. So that was another sign. And the third thing is, listen, there's a lot said about being the smartest guy in the room, but Gary Gensler in many meetings probably is the smartest guy in the room. So he knew what had to be done. He was willing, he was in a position to be able to do that and was willing to tell the folks at Wall Street, I don't care what you think. So that's how I looked at him 18 months ago. So the degree to which Gary Gensler was such a different candidate and is cannot be forgotten. And in a sense, it doesn't matter that he's a D or an R, but he happens to be a D and he's in that administration and that is helpful. But what I look at, frankly, the last 7 or 8 months and look at three data points in terms of fiduciary and Reg BI. I look at that March 30th FAQ regarding Form CRS. I look at the first case brought against based on Reg BI, and frankly, and then I look at the staff report of August regarding conflicts of interest. And I look at those three data points and say, huh, Jay Clayton could have done that just as well. And I mean that, and I don't say that lightly. I don't say that lightly at all. So, that on that basis, I think that anybody that is thinking that, that we can have faith in the SEC going forward, has to rethink that idea, frankly.
So, at this stage, look, I know, typically a think tank like yours, one of the main things that they do is reaching out to agencies, reaching out to lawmakers and advocating positions. But do you see value in that at this point? Are you making trips to the 10th floor?
The SEC is the SEC. And, you know, they have a unique and important position. That being said, you know, in terms of looking out more broadly into the environment and being optimistic, look at the state administrators, Kurt, and look at NASA. And, you know, there you find regulators that understand what it means, you know, that actually understand what we are talking about, who understand what other fiduciary advocates are talking about. And in a way that the SEC has demonstrated, it doesn't have a clue. It does not have a clue what we're talking about. So one reason to be optimistic is to look at the states and say, what can we accomplish at the states that cannot be accomplished at the SEC? You know, the single most important piece of research, perhaps in the last 5 years, came out from NASA last November when they did an evaluation of Reg BI. And it was pretty straightforward and clear. You know, they basically said the broker dealers haven't changed much of anything, and they're still doing the same thing they did 3 or 4 years ago. And so, and you know, this is based on extensive research and data gathering from numerous states. So one reason to be optimistic is to look at NASA. The other reason to be optimistic is to look at the degree to which the entrepreneurial spirits have energized a lot of new RIAs who are doing things and are connecting with investors in a way that I don't think we saw 5 or 10 years ago, and that they are, you know, they are becoming, I think, the new poster child for what it means to be in what it means to be an RIA. So I think and with the advent of social media, we can get messages across to a broader array of investors that we couldn't do 5 or 10 years ago. So that's another reason to be optimistic. And then, you know, that what is happening at the Department of Labor, which we haven't talked about, frankly, but, you know, the Department of Labor staff understand what it means to be a fiduciary. And I don't know how this is going to come out right now, but at least they understand it and are fighting for it. So there's another reason to be optimistic, frankly. So there are three things top of mind.
I like it. I love it. I love an optimistic tone. You know, the point about the state regulators is an interesting one. And actually, I know you were recently on the Investment News podcast with Jeff Benjamin and Bruce Kelly. And you mentioned something on there that I thought was really interesting. And you sort of held up the AICPA, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. We had Tom Hood on to talk about that a few weeks ago in episode 70. But you held out the AICPA as an example of, I think, what a model or a regulatory framework could look like for RIAs. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about how you're thinking about that.
Well, I think the AICPA is a model in the specific sense of how does a trade, and if you look at the independent experts, we in financial planning, financial advice, we're not a profession. We don't have the characteristics of a profession. So what do we have to do? This is all about how you become a profession. And AICPA is a good example of the fact that you have to do it through the states. You can't do it on a federal level. And, you know, and this is not new and this is not radical. This is the way professions come to life. This is how they develop. It's through the states. And, you know, there's lots of literature out there that support it. So the to me, the point of AICPA is just a good example that is parallel with financial planning. AICPA has its own financial planning segment, and there are a lot of CPAs who have gotten their designation on financial planning there. And so I think it's a relevant place for we in financial planning to look at. And there's going to be a longstanding discussion about whether it should be done through the federal level or the state level. And you know, I on some level, I don't understand the discussion because there is no case that I can see that for a real trade to become a real profession in terms of taking it through the federal level. And now, just on top of that historic perspective, to look at what the SEC has done and to look at what has been to go through Congress, to think that that's the way to advance a profession. Frankly, Kurt, I don't know what I can't make any sense of that myself. And I have reached out to several people and said, help me understand why this is the case. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. So that was the context which I was mentioning AICPA.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I really think it's a good point. It's a point well taken. And maybe that could be the future of your trade or your profession, perhaps, whichever word you use.
I think a sober analysis of the landscape says it's the best option right now. And I hear the arguments from the other side to say that we got to do it on a federal level. Many of these arguments come from CFP board. And so that is one side of it. But just based on the recent record, I just had literally don't understand how you can come to the conclusion that that's the best way to advance a trade into a profession.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I mean, I'm an attorney, so I'm a member of state bars. I understand exactly the model you're talking about. Well, Knut, look, I want to give you a chance for any last words. Anything I should have asked you? What have I missed that you would want to tell our listeners?
Well, I think that you already underscored what I said, that notwithstanding the situation with the SEC, there are so many reasons to be optimistic about the future of financial advice and financial planning. And that's what I think that is the takeaway that I want to leave people with. And and the context of dwelling on the SEC to me is the context of finding other ways to advance this thing called fiduciary, which is centuries old and which is well understood and which the Supreme Court understood it. And but we've got to find other ways to advance it because the SEC right now is not the way to do it. And I think that's what the record shows. But the work of financial planners and financial advisors, and I'm predominantly focused on the individual market, the retail market, and thinking about investors. I mean, that is extremely bright. I think that's the takeaway for me.
I mean, that's great. I think maybe one of the ways to advance the message is through education. We promised we were going to talk a little bit about Fiduciary September before we rounded out the episode today. So given that September is just closed, it's not too late. The Institute hosts what they call Fiduciary September every year. It is the largest annual conversation on the importance of fiduciary advice, and it features scholars, advisors, and former regulators who speak to the Institute on webinars and panels about fiduciary issues. So, can you tell us a little bit more? How can people find out about Fiduciary September? What kind of programs are available?
Right. Well, the first thing to find out more about is to go to our website, www.thefiduciaryinstitute.org. And you can link right from the homepage into, we have, I think, nine of our 10 panel videos up there that you can access, and that will take you onto YouTube. And so you can see the programming that we've done. You can see the individuals that are involved in our group. And part of that, I want to say that speaking on behalf of our board and the many advisors who are actively involved in what we do, I am so proud of the fact that we have some of the best known fiduciary luminaries in the industry out there. I mean, I can't say enough for Phyllis Borzi, what she did at the Department of Labor to raise the awareness of fiduciary. I can't say enough for Luis Aguilar, who served at the SEC until 5-7 years ago as one of the longest serving SEC commissioners in terms of his understanding and appreciation for fiduciary and his willingness to be associated with what we're doing. So that means a lot to us. And so that's the best way to begin. Our whole experience is on our website. And I encourage people to go there. We have just one last thing. We have just come out. We're actually going to come out tomorrow with a new, I call it a pamphlet. I think of Thomas Paine in Common Sense from history. I call it a pamphlet to sort of in a very brief time sort of explain what we do and why this matters. And we feature there Winston Churchill talking about defending democracy as World War II was about, and why he did that and how he did that. And I think that there's a parallel there in terms of defending and preserving fiduciary principles. So we've got the image of Winston Churchill out there associated with what we're doing in defending fiduciary principles. And so anyway, that I think to get on our website is a great place to begin.
Yeah, absolutely. Would highly recommend to all of our listeners to go and check out some of the content from Fiduciary September, or keep an eye out for this new pamphlet. Again, it is thefiduciaryinstitute.org. You can find all of those materials and other great content there. Knut, I've really enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you so much for coming on the Insecurities Podcast.
Well, listen, Kurt, thank you for having me. I appreciate the chance to sort of tell a little bit more of our story, and I look forward to staying in contact with you going forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Insecurities Podcast. And a special thanks to our guest, Knut Rostad. As always, we would like to hear from you with any of your thoughts about the Insecurities Podcast and with recommendations for any topics we should cover on future episodes. Please use the hashtag InsecuritiesPod on Twitter or LinkedIn to join the conversation. And you can follow me at @enforce_update. Of course, you can follow my co-host Chris at @EkimoffCPA. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll hear from you soon.
Thanks for listening to Insecurities, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is a nonprofit provider of authoritative professional services training and continuing education. In an increasingly complex business environment where intricate corporate structures reign, Insecurities can help you make sense of it all. A special thanks goes to the producer of Insecurities, Daniel Pinitz, as well as hosts Chris Ekimoff and Kurt Wolf. For more information about PLI's SEC Institute, or to view hundreds of hours of fresh and relevant on-demand programming covering changes within the security sector, visit pli.edu/membership and sign up for a privileged membership. These recorded materials are designed for educational purposes only. This podcast does not constitute legal, audit, tax, consulting, business, financial, investment, or other professional advice, and it does not create an attorney-client relationship. Please consult a qualified professional advisor before taking any action based on the information herein. Furthermore, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual participants. These views are not the views of the hosts or their employers. Users of this podcast may save and use the podcast only for personal or other non-commercial educational purposes. No other use, including without limitation, reproduction, retransmission, or editing of this podcast may be made without the prior written permission from PLI.